Hey there, welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm your host, John Spencer. I'm a former middle school teacher, current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity. And so on this show, I share ideas and strategies, I tell stories, I share blueprints, I talk about things that worked and things that didn't work, and I also talk to experts. And today on this episode, I got a chance to talk to someone who's not only an expert, but actually is a hero of mine. She was profoundly influential for me in this idea of empowering students with voice and choice in the area of English language arts. Now, in particular, for me, a lot of it came down to what she had said about and what she had written about reading. But it's also every part of it. It's putting together a great classroom library, it's writing, it's every aspect of ELA. And who I'm interviewing is Donalyn Miller. She's a leading expert on independent reading and children's literature. She's the author of three bestsellers, The Book Whisperer, Reading in the Wild, and Game Changer, Book Access for All Kids, co-authored with Colby Sharp. She is the founder of the annual Book A Day event, co-founder of the Nerdy Book Club with Colby Sharp, and the co-host of the monthly Twitter chat, hashtag Title Talk. So without further ado, here is my interview with Donalyn Miller. I would love to just really begin with this concept of with your story. How did you, like I said, I absolutely loved The Book Whisperer. I loved that shaped my thinking. And on one hand, you know, it had been a couple of years I had been doing reading intervention at that point and doing choice-based reading, but not finding anyone who was explaining it to me in a clear way. So that book both affirmed a lot of these ideas I had, but also gave me some really practical ideas and the permission that I think I didn't know I had, right? So it was foundational for me. I would love for you to share your story of where did you land in that place yourself? How did you get to that place of empowering students in their reading?
Well, thanks for giving me such a good question to think about right off the bat. I have been a reader almost all of my life. I'm 55 now. I really don't have many memories before I knew I was a reader. So probably 5 or 6. I went to private kindergarten. A lot of people did back then. And I was reading by the time I started the first grade. I taught my little sister how to read. Mm-hmm. But I always kind of had this reading thing going on that was mine. And then the reading work that we did at school, you know, SRA cards, whole class novels. And by the time I was in high school, I was pretty much an underground reader, as I've described, where I was reading Stephen King books out of my desk while my teacher spent 2 months, you know, belaboring The Scarlet Letter. Uh-huh. And so when I became a teacher, and I was a second career teacher, I worked in hotel restaurant management before that. And when I became a teacher, I really had this vision of getting kids excited about reading the way I had been, because I mm-hmm. knew that reading had helped me get an education. I worked my way through school, and I really felt like reading helped me because I didn't have some of the enrichment opportunities that my peers did growing up. I didn't go to camp. You know, I spent my summers babysitting my younger siblings when my parents worked, which meant I just read all summer long and, you know, watched MTV. But I wanted kids to have that opportunity that I knew books had provided me. And then I became a teacher and I just started doing what the other teachers did, which is going down to the teacher supply store and buying the novel unit sets that they made at the time and going in, and we would spend not 8 weeks, maybe not 2 months perhaps, but maybe a month reading a book. And I knew I was missing something, but I really thought it was because I was a second career teacher and that the teachers who'd been in like 10 years had figured some things out. Mm-hmm. And so I started trying to talk to some of them, to be honest. And my principal, Ron Myers, I followed that man to 3 different schools in 2 different districts. But he introduced me to this woman named Susan Kelly, who was in fifth grade and I was in sixth, and she was a reading and writing workshop person. Mm-hmm. And she introduced me to Nancy Atwell. Mm-hmm. And I read In the Middle and it blew my mind, to be honest. Mm-hmm. And it was like, it was something that it was like the brass ring, right? It was like, I could do this. I could mm-hmm. make my class like this and it would be better. Mm-hmm. And then I started trying to do it. And it was so bad. But, you know, it's the way it always is. Like, I spent about more than a half a school year, John, trying to channel Nancy Atwell. And mm-hmm. just if I wasn't doing it right, I really mm-hmm. just like there was a right way to do it and I wasn't doing it. And then I was sitting, I remember clearly, I can still see it. It's been almost 20 years. Sitting at my desk and I was beating myself up looking at my conference list mm-hmm. because I hadn't gotten to all my kids in a reading conference that week. Mm-hmm. And I thought, it's this epiphany came over me that Nancy wasn't coming to help me. Nancy Atwell was not going to show up at my doorway and tell me I was doing it wrong. And she also wasn't going to help me with my kids in a Texas suburb. I needed to figure this out for myself. So did I believe in the belief? And, you know, one of the things Ron taught me, he taught me, you know, we talk in our profession a lot about paradigm shift, mm-hmm. how we make paradigm shifts in our thinking and we move, you know, we move into a place of thinking that we weren't before. First, I thought this, now I thought this. But Ron talked a bit about paradigm drift. Mm-hmm. This idea that we have firmly held beliefs about teaching and learning. And we want our practices to align with our beliefs. Mm-hmm. But over time, we make incremental compromises and adjustments that move us away from those core beliefs in ways that we may not even realize. Mm-hmm. And I realized that's what I was doing with reading. Like I had this belief about what reading could be, but my day-to-day practices in the classroom were never going to get most of my kids there. Mm-hmm. And I needed to figure out what the gap was. Instead of almost like playing school. And you know what I mean like that? I feel like sometimes we go into teaching playing school. We know what school looks like because we were a kid in school. And we fall back on sometimes the things that we remember school being like. And everybody reading a book for 2 months is certainly something that a lot of us have experienced. Spelling lists, diagramming sentences. I mean, we could think about some of those practices that are not in favor anymore because we've evolved. And I just decided that I needed to be more reflective and responsive with my own students and what they were telling me. I had that foundation that Susie and Nancy Atwell and the other things that I've been reading at the time gave me. But ultimately, where the rubber meets the road, it was me and my kids. And I have learned more. I have learned more from the kids I have taught than any book I have ever read. And I know that the people who read my books, I hope it's the same for them.
Yeah.
Because the best tools we have as teachers are kid watching mm-hmm. and reflective practice, I think. Like, what are my kids telling me that they know? What are they telling me that they need? What are they telling me that they need next? What can I do about it? Okay, I tried that. Did it work? Did it not work? Did it work for some of them? Yeah. You know, did it work for none of them? You know, 'cause that happens too. And I think I didn't really know, you know, I didn't set out to write about any of these things. I just wanted my kids to like reading.
Yeah.
You know? And I hear from them all the time. So many of them do. They're grown now, my Book Whisperer kids.
Oh my goodness. You know, it's real interesting. When I was a kid, we had a reading competition at our school. And if you read a certain number of books, you would get, you know, a pizza coupon or whatever. And there was an award assembly and mm-hmm. Parents had to sign the permission slip and my mom didn't sign it. And she said something that I say all the time to my college students that I teach, reading is rewarding when there's no reward for reading, right? Mm-hmm. That reading is a reward. So she just said, don't track how many books you're reading and and whatever. And I actually think there's value in tracking the number of books. Like, I think it's fun that people say, I've read 75 books this year. Like, that's totally great. I'm not anti-tracking. I'm not saying. But her point was she didn't want me to lose sight on why we read. And in our house, reading wasn't a big deal. It was like breathing. There was newspaper on the kitchen table. There were magazines in the bathroom, which is a little bit gross. There was books everywhere on the bookshelves. If you'd said, were you into reading as a kid? As a kid, I would have said, no, I'm into history and politics and sports and this. And I could tell you everything I was into. But reading was just how you learn about it.
Like, it was a backdrop for everything. It was just
in their house. You know, it was not something to be celebrated. It was not something to be rewarded. It was, you know, and so when it was over, I still remember my mom pulled me from, and my siblings, from school. So we didn't go to the assembly. And she took us out for pizza, right? And then she took us to the, you know, local bookstore. And it was a used bookstore, but we didn't care. And we got to pick out 3 books. And that was our reward. And, you know, it was just, and it was real interesting because one of the things that I think about is the intentions were really good of that program, right? But my mom knew something about me. I'm not going to say this is true of every kid, but about me, that I would begin to view reading as a chore that required a reward. And that was dangerous, right? So question I have for you after sharing that long story is, what do you think are the well-intentioned things in reading that are actually doing more harm than good?
First, I love your mom. And I think that's the most awesome story. And my mom rescued me from cheating on SRA cards one time in the 1970s because I was giving out the answers to the other kids because I hated SRA cards. And I feel like my mom and your mom would get along. Mike Schmoker, you know, he has written some books. We read a few of them in my schools over the years. And I remember him talking about instructional wallpaper. Mm. You know, when you buy wallpaper, you just moved. I just moved. Maybe we bought some wallpaper. When you put up wallpaper, it's a big deal. Getting wallpaper, right? You're looking at a lot of wallpaper. You're talking about a lot of wallpaper. You're figuring out the tools you need or who you need to hire or what you need to look for to put up the wallpaper. You put up that wallpaper and 6 months later, you don't even consider the wallpaper that much anymore. Mm-hmm. And Mike Schmoker talked about how we do this with instructional practices, right? We study them. We look at them from every angle, perhaps. We discuss them. We debate them. We compare different ideas, perhaps. And then we put something in place. And then we never go back and look at the wallpaper again.
Yeah.
And I think one of the examples that stands out to me the most in this is reading logs.
Yeah.
You know, the home, and when I talk about reading log, because there's always someone who wants to find a sliver of daylight in here, and I don't want your listeners to misunderstand me when I say, this is what I mean when I talk about a reading log. A reading log is a record of minutes or pages that children are asked to complete at home in order to document their home reading. Mm-hmm. Sometimes these are graded assignments. Sometimes they are assignments that require parent participation in either questioning the child about their reading or signing the document or all of the above. So that is what I mean by reading log. Mm-hmm. And I will tell you, as someone who taught sixth graders, when I announced to parents that we were not doing reading logs, they burst out in applause at Meet the Teacher every year.
Yeah.
I had parents tell me they would fill out that log on Mondays.
Yeah.
So they wouldn't forget. I was a band parent, had kids in band. I remember that practice log on Fridays. Sign, sign, sign. I heard the clarinet. It was every single day, wasn't it? I feel like I heard it every day. Sign, sign, sign.
I was like, I have no idea. I know my kids are reading because we're all reading.
My kids are reading too. But
I don't know the number of pages, you know.
Well, we think that log is doing something. And I think this is what we think the log is doing. We think it's forcing parents to make sure that their kids are reading. Mm-hmm. And it is doing no such thing. parents are signing that log in Friday mornings if they can find a pen in the car, right? The kids who, they may be filling it out on Mondays. Your kids who are reading a lot may not even find that paper in their backpack to bring back as any kind of evidence.
Yeah.
You have kids that love to read. They might be reading an hour and a half a day, but they don't tell you that. They write 30 minutes on that log for you because that's what the log is about. That log is also no evidence that any reading with comprehension took place.
Yeah.
Kids can log pages, and it's no evidence of progress or reading growth either. Mm-hmm. It is really a compliance piece. And if we can dig down to where we can admit that to ourselves, then we can really start to question its value. Because it's not working as a compliance piece either. It's not getting parents or kids to do anything. And I have taught kids who have come into my classroom and they have told me, John, that they have read two books in fifth grade or one book in fifth grade. But you know what they turned in every single Friday to their teacher? A reading log.
Yeah.
Kids can log pages and minutes forever and never even finish a book. So I think that's a practice that it's not as popular as it was when I began teaching. It was pretty much everyone did it when I began teaching. I did it because my entire department did it. And it was just kind of everybody sent home reading logs. Well, okay, I'll go do that too. And then if you're reflective, like we already talked about, if you're watching kids and you're being self-reflective, you can see that that log doesn't work. Some other things, I mean, you asked me to come up with a lot of things, maybe perhaps a couple of examples. That was one really long one, but a quicker example, whole class novels. You know, now I'm not going to say we should not have shared reading experiences. Of course we should. I'm not saying we shouldn't sit with kids with a longer work and analyze it and look at it in different ways. Of course we should. But we really have to look at the balance between reading and reading related activities in the classroom. What I call language arts and crafts.
Yes.
You know, it's we read one chapter and then we make a diorama. We read another chapter and we do a crossword puzzle. Or if we're older kids, we read a chapter, record 20 annotations for every chapter, answer 3 prompts. And we drag kids through a book like that. And it's really just for the purposes of grading. Mm-hmm. It's a grade generator.
I love that you bring this up, because one of the things I think about when I hear this is we need to be able to be critical of certain ineffective practices without it being, we're critical of teachers, or teachers are bad. And I mentioned this because I remember an example where I didn't name the teacher. But I said, look, my son read Fahrenheit 451 in 3 days and loved it. And then he read Brave New World. And then he read 1984. And I gave him an essay from Neil Postman about the comparison of 1984 and Brave New World, and why Postman thought we would be more like Brave New World than we would be like, 1984. And
hopefully,
rich discussions at home, and he and I are talking about it. And I ask him, what do you think is going to happen when authoritarian governments begin to figure out how to use and manipulate AI, right? When we're beginning to see this massive thing with AI and ChatGPT now, right? But this was, the beginning of COVID, and we're having this rich conversation for three, four days. And he is not the kid who reads all the time. He is the kid who gets really into two or three books and just reads for 3 straight weeks, and then might read a book once in a while for a month, and then moves, that's his style. And I've just gotten used to, that's who he is. He's an avid reader, but it's up and down depending on what he's into. So he reads that. And then I see him with his book out and he's stressing, and I'm like, what's going on? And he said, I have to, I have to do this claim quote evidence log for every page in 1980 in Fahrenheit 451. And I mentioned it. I said, I think this is not helping anybody right here. I don't think this is helpful for him. I don't think this helps the struggling reader either. I think we got to be able to call that a bad practice. And I remember, a lot of people said, don't be critical of the teachers. Teaching is hard right now, and all this kind of stuff. And my point wasn't that this was a bad teacher. My point was, this is a bad practice, and we need to admit, look, this is a bad practice?
You know, ultimately, teachers should be experts in their own kids in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to cross the line on that. I don't know your kids, you know, but I, if you want to come talk to me about how things like reading incentives and whole class novels and reading logs benefit your kids and they're really good for your kids, I'm really going to dig down with you on that because I don't think it's benefiting all of them. Mm-hmm. And what we see historically happen is things like that advantage kids with the most resources. Mm-hmm. In all the ways they have resources. The kids who have the parent at home to sign the reading log, the mm-hmm. parent who has the kid to sit there and go through claim and evidence questions with home reading at night, the kids who have, you know, access to the library or they own books at home so they can participate in that readathon. You know, we often, those practices often advantage our kids who have the most resources too. And I'm very cautious that such competition, such kinds of competitive grading, logs, these kinds of things all create a culture of winners and losers. And I don't know why we would ever want to create a culture where we had reading losers and reading winners at a school. It just, and I know I'm a little existential on this stuff, John, but it is kind of my life's work. And I know you feel that way too, but somebody needs to be, right? Somebody needs to be looking at the forest and not the trees. And I'm happy to be one of those people. But it's, our profession is an evolving one because literacy is evolving at an exponential rate. I think about what stood for literacy when I was a kid growing up in the 70s and 80s and what it looks like now. And it is hubris to even think that we are preparing kids for the future. We have no idea what it even looks like. Yeah. No idea. I mean, I'm sure my typing teacher in 1984, and by the way, I read 1984 in 1984 because I was a junior in high school and there was a movie out in the 80s, if you recall. But I, where was I going with that? But I don't know. I lost my
thought. You can't predict the future.
Oh, we can't predict the future. I'm sure my typing teacher in 1984, that's where we were. I'm sure she thought she was really teaching me something when she taught me how to use correction tape. You know, yeah. I mean, that was important. She really hammered that to us about, you know, how to use it and how to conserve it. And guess what? I don't know. I don't use it anymore.
It's, I remember- You know, when I taught my last couple of years in classroom, so I taught STEM and I taught journalism, right? And yep. what I remember having conversations with people saying, I'm going to teach STEM. It's going to be project-based, but I'm not going to convert this class into a coding class, which was the big trend at the time, right? Mm-hmm. Think about 8, 9 years ago, you know, you saw that. And now, when I think about it, I literally tested this out, just used ChatGPT, and I gave a prompt that I would have given kids in coding that they would have done, and the AI spit it out in 20 seconds, and it was flawless. And in the meantime, being a citizen journalist, documenting your world, knowing your context, being empathetic, deciphering facts, all of these things turn out to be really, really important. Mm-hmm. Right? The journalism class, I would argue, turned out to be very relevant. Whether kids become journalists or not, can they think like journalists, right? That turns out to be really, really important for a fragile democracy, right? And I'm just struck by that the fixation on will this prepare students for the future is often short-sighted, and there's this hubris attached to like actually believing that you can predict the future, which you rarely can. And so if that's the case, if the future is unpredictable, I'm curious, in your perspective, how can reading, which you've been all about, that's your life's work, and writing too, I don't want to minimize the writing piece, so language arts, right? How do you see the language arts and more broadly the humanities helping students through that unpredictable world?
Well, I don't think we can fully participate in a democracy without literacy. I think literacy is democracy. Democracy is literacy. I just, as far as that overlapping between the humanities and the sciences, you know, I have a science degree. It's like there's no overlap there. It just is the world, right? I thought when I was in college, I was going to become a life and earth science teacher and or a world geography teacher. But I became all of those things because I became a literacy teacher, right? I think we're missing out on an opportunity to really show kids the value of literacy when we minimize its importance in classes like science, in classes like mathematics, in classes like history. It's not just a tool for accessing and manipulating information, which it certainly is, creating also. Mm-hmm. But we've had 5 or 6 studies now that show that reading, particularly reading fiction, fosters empathy.
Yeah.
And it doesn't just empathy's many different components, mm-hmm. but one of the one components of empathy that we seem to build early on in life or start to build is perspective taking. Mm-hmm. The ability to put ourselves in someone else's circumstances or conditions and look at something through their perspective or point of view. And when we're walking into stories, we're doing that every single time, right? Mm-hmm. We're also missing an opportunity, I believe, to show kids the beauty of science, the beauty of math, the humanity in those disciplines by not sharing with them. I mean, kids aren't becoming scientists because of the textbook reading that they're doing. That's not inspiring someone to become a scientist. But you read a science writing, like we talked about Ed Yong, you know, I think about others. Their ability to use language is what brings the science to life. And his reporting on the pandemic, you know, this is a man who is a journalist, yes, but he also understands the power of language and how to use it to its maximum effect. And some people are going to respond to just facts and data and information, but we as a species need our stories, right? Mm-hmm. I remember a book that was really written for, I think, the business profession when I was a reading ambassador for Scholastic, the vice president of the book fairs division. Mm-hmm. Was always book talking books to us. And he would always, Alan Boyko would always give me books to read. And then he would call me a week later and ask me if I had read them. But cool. But I think the book was called Whoever Tells the Best Story Wins. And it's about this idea that the data behind everything is often not what moves people or sticks with them. That people who are often the most successful in getting fundraising, in getting attention on their work, are the people who tell the best stories around that data. You think about Steve Jobs and how, you know, the Apple wasn't even the best at some of the things that they were trying to compete in, but he made us believe in the story. So we all lined up to buy everything, right? All the things. And, it's an interplay of the human experience here. And we wouldn't want to bifurcate that and say, okay, only this side matters. Only this side matters. All of it matters. We don't know what the world will look like for our kids, but we have always had our stories. We've always had our ways of communicating with one another. What I find really fascinating is how visual literacy keeps changing again and again. Because you think about the earliest evidence we have of human civilization, cave paintings, mm-hmm. hieroglyphs, pictorial communication, and look at what we're doing now. Mm-hmm. I mean, what are emojis if not 21st century hieroglyphs, yeah. right? I mean, really, you know, I mean, it's really kind of, you can see, I know you find this interesting too, but it's that whole idea of like, this is the human experience. And it's like, we're moving forward while we're still taking everything with us. And mm-hmm. that pictorial visual literacy is still a part of who we are. The alphabet began from pictorial drawings, right? And then I have a colleague of ours, Kristen Zemke and Katie Mataris, you might know their work on digital literacy and Read the World and some other things that they've done. But they talk about how visual literacy may be one of the most important literacies we're not teaching enough of.
Yeah.
Do kids know how to read a photograph? Do they know how to read a video? Do they know how to compare and evaluate information to, and images to even see if it's real. And now that all this AI stuff is coming in, I saw your conversation about it on Twitter. I mean, how is that going to affect everything? As an author and an art appreciator, I have some real concerns about AI. But as a reader and a writer and a consumer of information and stories, I'm fascinated by it too, right?
I'm fascinated by it. I'm scared by it. I'm excited by it. I feel a mix of emotions. You know, you brought up visual literacy, and I'm interested in something connected back to this idea of student choice and empowering readers, right? Mm-hmm. And it is this. I often see an attitude at school of fiction should be choice-based, go to the library, find your favorite books, that kind of stuff. And then nonfiction is treated like the vegetables that you have to eat that you don't want to eat, right? Or nonfiction is sort of like the HIIT workout, whereas, you know, the novel is the fun thing, the fun group activity. Like, there's just this idea of informational text is necessary, fiction is fun. And I think both are fun and both are necessary, right? And so I'm curious, where do you see choice and interest and motivation and excitement, you know, falling in love with reading should include nonfiction. Mm-hmm. Where do you see that playing out?
Oh, yeah, I talked about this a little bit in my second book, Reading in the Wild, because mm-hmm. you and I've taught older kids, but I've also raised a couple of kids, and you have as well. And when you're raising a 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 year old, so many questions all day long. Mommy, why is the sky blue? Mommy, why is that snail there? You know, it's just, what is a snail? You know, and I know what those things are, but do I know how to developmentally explain them to a 5 year old? Maybe I don't, but you know who does? Gail Gibbons, Seymour Simon, you know, some of the great science writers that we've had over the years, Melissa Stewart, some others. And they help me talk to my kids about those things.
Yeah.
Little kids love nonfiction. They prefer nonfiction. My grandson is 5. He wants to read about sharks, you know, all day long. The animal facts, you know, he loves all of that stuff. He likes the stories too. But what I saw happening with my middle school students, and I remember I talk about it, I titled that section Dead Presidents and Whales, because I had a student in my class, Ashley, who I tried all year to get her to read a nonfiction book in my class, and she just wouldn't. And she was so adventurous in all the fiction reading that she was doing, I was really kind of surprised. And when you have a kid who already loves to read, you want some meaningful goals for all of your kids. And I was like, you know, this is Ashley's goal here. Because she's 11, 12, and she's already telling me she hates nonfiction. Maybe we could do something about that at 11. And I asked her about it, and she says, nobody reads nonfiction for fun, Mrs. Miller. It's all about dead presidents and whales. That's what she said. And I started thinking, okay, what happened between 5-year-old Ashley, who wanted to know what sunlight was, and 12-year-old Ashley, who thinks it's all about dead presidents? Because when kids tell us they don't like to read something, or when adults show disdain for something in reading, I have to presume they don't have that much experience with it. No. Or the experience that they have is negative. Recognizing that when we're building a reading identity, negative experiences and the lack of an experience have just as much impact on us. You know, read alouds have an impact on us. Not being read aloud to also has an impact on us. So what I dug into, what have my older kids' experiences with nonfiction really have been? And what I saw happening first, I looked at it in my own self, book talking in the classroom, promoting books to kids. What was the ratio? I took my own little survey of myself. The data was not positive. I was overwhelmingly promoting fiction in my class more than nonfiction. And I don't mean like 60-40. It was like 85-15. Yeah. And I was also nonfiction promotion was more on a kid by kid basis than on a whole class basis. Mm-hmm. I knew the kid liked nonfiction, and that's why I was recommending it to them. But standing up in front of the whole class and just talking about a great work of nonfiction with my students, it did not happen as much. So that was one thing I could do. When we don't see kids reading enough of something, then we need to bless it more. And my kids weren't reading enough nonfiction and they disliked it. So maybe they just didn't even know what books were available for them to read. The other part is I looked at things like read alouds and what our read aloud rotation looks like. And I read a lot of nonfiction with my students in social studies because it was a great background knowledge builder. But I realized looking at what I was reading with my kids that almost all of the nonfiction that my students read in the sixth grade was short. Mm-hmm. And by that, I mean two page test passage or web article or a picture book that I read out loud to them or this section of a textbook. They really didn't have much experience or even encouragement to read longer works of nonfiction, like an entire biography or an entire book about a historical topic or a science topic. And I felt like that might be an experience that some of them would enjoy if they even knew it was a possibility. So it becomes looking at, one, we complain that kids don't read, and then we start to incrementally complain about everything that they read. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we can have it both ways. You know, you can read as long as you read this, 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 and this. Yeah. And, oh yeah, nonfiction.
And I was guilty of that. You know, I remember too. For me it was format, right? So for me, mm-hmm. I believed that I love nonfiction, but most of my kids didn't. And so I remember my own journey of book talks were heavily fiction. I started adding nonfiction to book talks. But also my classroom library was 80%, 90% fiction. And for me, I had a moment where a student just said, "What do you read?" We're doing silent reading. It was self-contained at the time. And I was reading, Predictably Irrational. And a kid said, "Well, what's that about?" And I started talking about behavioral economics, about these counterintuitive things, about how we make a decision. And he said, "Well, when you're done with it, can I borrow it?" And I was like, "Well, I've got another copy that I lent out to a friend." Like, "Yeah, go ahead. Like, just take this one." And it was this weird, like, oh, wait, other kids might like that. They might nerd out on human motivation and psychology and that kind of stuff. However, so I came aboard that pretty well and felt good about it. On the other hand, I was one of those teachers who believed graphic novels didn't count, audiobooks didn't count. Do you know what I mean? Like, that was my issue. Was I felt like if they're not decoding letters the entire time, it's not real reading. And that was a really hard paradigm shift for me to make. And so I'm curious, what would you do to help teachers who are struggling with the notion that a graphic novel counts, an audiobook counts?
Well, the question I would ask would be, counts for whom? Oh, yeah. Because it sure counts for the kids who read them.
Yeah.
It sure counts for the people who create them for the kids. It sure counts for that librarian who got it because she knew kids would check it out. Yeah. So who does it count for? Well, it doesn't count for you. Yeah. But that says more about you than it says about the book, right? So again, another existential way of looking at it. But the other piece is, who gets to decide what a reader is? Mm. Who gets to decide what a reader is? I mean, if you really drill down to it, what am I really a scholar of ultimately? Mm. And I could spend the rest of my life fascinated with that word reader. Mm-hmm. Like, how do people see themselves in that word? What does that word mean to them? How do they see themselves positively in that word? How do they see themselves negatively in that word? Mm-hmm. What are the boundaries of that word for them? And how did they get there? And I've talked to thousands of readers over my career of all ages now. I mean, I talk to adult readers now equally as much as I talk to kid readers, which is really fascinating. And because the kids are so open and pure about it, and reading is complicated for some adults, and it's that journey that they've been through over their reading experiences. I talk to a lot of people, often men, who tell me that they don't see themselves as a reader, but when I start talking to them, they're reading a lot of nonfiction. like you just said. But the definition of a reader has been so narrowed and defined for them by someone else. They don't see themselves in the word anymore. So I think the first thing we have to do is say, who gets to decide what a reader is? Well, you get to decide what a reader is for you, and I get to decide what a reader is for me. And other beyond that literal definition of a reader is someone who reads.
Yeah.
The rest of that definition belongs to the reader themselves. It is again that idea that we have a lot of short-term goals for kids, but what's that long-term vision for them as a reader? Do we even think about it?
Yeah.
Do they even hold a vision of themselves as a reader in the future? How are we helping them hold a vision of themselves as a reader in the future positively?
Yeah.
There's some identity formation going on there for sure. In the same way that kids start to build a box around what they think a scientist is or what they think an artist is, they build a box around what they think a reader is too.
Yeah.
And that is often, that box is often constructed for them by adults.
I love that. That's a great point. Well, I really appreciate you just being willing to do this interview and have this conversation. I had so many more questions I wanted to ask about setting up classroom library. I have questions that are very specific related to that. Some questions I had around how teachers could handle the contentious book banning nature of what's going on right now.
Oh, I have things to say.
Big things. So maybe at some point we could do a follow-up interview, because I really enjoyed this time together. You are one of my heroes in the reading world, and your ideas really shaped a lot of my own practice. So this was an honor to get a chance to interview you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for inviting me. I hope that the conversation is useful to your listeners, your subscribers. I appreciate you as well and the work that you're doing out in the world. And I'm just glad that we're all in community together, right? Like your listeners, me, you, all of us together, striving for some of the things, same things, a better world.
Thank you.
And we get to do that with kids. Isn't that great?
It's great. And then final question, if people want to get in touch, what is the best way in terms of books that they should check out, in terms of your website? What's the best way?
I have my website at bookwhisperer.com. It's undergoing an overhaul. This over the holiday break, it's a good time to go in and do some behind the scenes tweaking on the website. I have my two new books that have come out this year. And the most recent one is the Common Sense Guide for Your Classroom Library that I wrote with Colby Sharp. Colby and I have been collaborators for a while, and it's our second book together. And then in May, my book, The Joy of Reading, which I co-wrote with my dear friend, Dr. Terry Lassane, came out. And it was the work of a lifetime. We spent 7 years working on that book. It's basically everything Terry and her illustrious 50 years in education, you know, it's everything that we have learned about engaging children with reading over the course of our careers. Sadly, Terry passed away last year in August, John, and she never got to see the book published. But the amazement that book has her last thinking in it, you know, that's so special to me. And that I may get to introduce Terry to people who maybe didn't get to learn from her when she was with us. But thank you for what you're doing. Thank you for the program. I know it's doing a lot of good in the world, and it's certainly helping teachers and kids.
All right. Thank you. All right. So there you have it. That was Donalyn Miller, author of many different amazing books on empowering students with voice and choice in language arts, especially in reading. I hope you enjoyed that interview as much as I did. If you enjoy this podcast, would you do me a favor and leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or wherever it is that you get your podcast? That would mean a lot to me. And if you don't subscribe to my YouTube channel, go to spencervideos.com. I'd love to have you subscribe there as well. Thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day, and go out and make something awesome.